The Fine Line Between Compromise and Corruption.
The book is meant to explore, and I hope does explore, what it takes to get and hold power. And what do you do in terms of compromises that are worth it because you've improved the lot of all kinds of people? And which ones do you just kind of slip into utter corruption?
That's Kevin Baker. We talk with him about his terrific new novel based on the greatest unsolved murder in New York's history and the politician who was implicated in it. The book is The Big Crowd. Then we hear a ghost story, and then I review John Bradshaw's book, Cat Sense. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Riano. Novelist Kevin Baker has a love affair with New York. His City of Fire trilogy, the novels Dreamland, Paradise Valley, and Stryver's Row, dealt with those who helped build New York, the Irish, the Jews, and African Americans, but were often reviled by the city's power class. His new novel, The Big Crowd, is based on the true story of two Irish immigrant brothers, one who became the mayor of New York, and his younger brother, a crusading reformer. In The Big Crowd, the brothers are Charlie and Tom O'Kane. Charlie slides into the mayor's seat on a path greased by Tammany Hall, the machine run by the mob, the Poles, and the tycoons, who've divided up the spoils of the city as their own personal trough of power and treasure. All is copacetic until an investigation into mob activities leads to one of the greatest unsolved murders in New York history. Kevin Baker thinks he knows the answer to that mystery, and he spins a tale around it that is a riveting and thought-provoking read. Well, Kevin Baker, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks for having me.
This book, The Big Crowd, first of all, it was mesmerizing to read this story. I'm a New Yorker, and I actually didn't know much of this history since I was a wee child, when the events upon which most of the action are based happened. You did not grow up in New York City, is that right? You grew up in Massachusetts.
Yeah, I was born in New Jersey, but we moved up to Massachusetts, the North Shore of Massachusetts, when I was about 8. And both my parents were born in the city. We had a lot of family around here. But I didn't really come back to New York until 1976.
That's an interesting time to come back, as a matter of fact. It was a pretty gritty city then, too.
I think if I'd been older, it would have scared me a lot, but I loved it. You know, I was just starting college, and that's always a great time in anyone's life. And it just seemed so wonderfully exciting and alive. And it was, you know, it's almost become an underrated time now. I don't want to romanticize the poverty and the crime and the other problems, but it was a very vivid, very lively city even then.
And you have written a historical trilogy of New York, City of Fire, and that's apart from this book, The Big Crowd, which also focuses on it. Why have you made New York City the center of so much of your work?
Well, I think because it's been really the center of so much of America. I mean, in many ways, New York, as other people have said too, is sort of the real heartland. This is where everybody has come through, pretty much, at least to start. And this is where the great battles for American democracy have been fought out. It's the most, probably the most single fought over patch of land in all of the country, when you consider, you know, from the Revolution, the draft riots, and the Civil War, innumerable battles for labor rights, women's rights, gay and lesbian rights, you know, the Stonewall riot. This has really been where we've had it out over what it means to be, over who is going to be an American and what it means to be an American. The City of Fire trilogy, Dreamland, Paradise Alley, and Stryver's Row, was about three immigrant or migrant groups who were not wanted in America except in the most silent and subservient positions. Mm-hmm. That is to say, Jews, Irish, and African Americans, and yet found ways to push their way in as full citizens and, you know, contributed so much to our culture and our, you know, our history in general. And that struggle, that process fascinated me. So that's what became the City of Fire trilogy. It takes place at three key moments in the city and the country's history. Paradise Alley during the Civil War and the draft riots with the Irish, Dreamland around the turn of the century, and the Triangle Fire and the Stryver's Row during World War II in Harlem. So those were these amazingly turbulent times, people pushing to the top. This new book, The Big Crowd, I see as the start of another trilogy of books focusing on, kind of tentatively calling it The City of Gold. I'm going to focus on a period, the post-war era, the kind of fabled post-war era of New York, when the city was in many ways at its zenith. It was pretty much the only unconquered and unbowed, unbloodied city in the world, major city in the world, or at least the Western world. It was the capital of all these things in the world, like culture, finance, and everything else. And yet, there were these sort of, you know, cracks, these kind of subtle fissures opening up under its foundation that were going to really undermine a lot of the great things that were here.
And you take the story up based closely on one of the greatest unsolved murders in the history of New York and in the history of the mob in New York.
Yeah, it's a great kind of locked door mystery. It revolves around an actual mob witness, probably the greatest mob witness of all time, a horrible little man named Abe Reles. He was the second Kid Twist. These gangsters often took on other gangsters' names. And he closed some 85 capital cases. And his testimony was essential in sending some seven different members of Murder Incorporated to the electric chair, including, to this day, the only mob leader ever executed in the United States, Louis Lepke Buckalter. And yet, he ended up, before he was about to testify one more time, he ended up going out the window, the sixth-story window of this old hotel out on Coney Island, where he was being held under 24-hour, 18-man police guard behind a steel door on this entire suite, this entire wing of the hotel. And yet somehow he ended up almost undoubtedly thrown out the window of that hotel. And this became the center of the book, and it's one of the, really is maybe the greatest unsolved, officially unsolved mob murder in history.
Now, we won't give the conclusion away, but
right.
How much do you think that your solution to the mystery might actually be the real one?
Well, I think there's a very good chance mine is the real one based on certain things. I think it's very possible it's the real one. And I base this not simply on my conjecture, but on the musings of many people about it, including Burton Turkus, who was the assistant DA of Brooklyn at the time, who put away a lot of Murder, Inc., prosecuted a lot of these cases, based on other things I picked up in researching this. So, you know, at the end of the book, I lay out the kind of factual conjecture, if that really it's kind of an oxymoron, but I lay out the facts behind the case and why I reached the conclusion I did.
You just talked about Abe Reles, but the action of the book and the emotional heart of the book really centers around the relationship of two brothers, both based on real people, Charlie O'Kane and his brother Tom. First, tell us about these characters, and then tell us about the real people they were based on.
Yeah, they're based on this now oddly forgotten. I mean, it's amazing how much of this has just been lost to memory, but they're based on the O'Dwyer brothers. And William O'Dwyer was this classic American success story. He was one of many, many children from County Mayo, the poorest county in Ireland. He was trying to be a priest for a while, but gave that up, came to America, started with nothing, really had just penniless, you know, worked at various jobs, was a hod carrier and construction crews, became a beat cop, went to law school at night, became a magistrate judge in Brooklyn, and then became the district attorney of Brooklyn. And then went off and became, you know, this administrator and investigator during World War II, was something of a war hero for helping save a lot of Italy from starvation, came back, gets elected mayor overwhelmingly is, you know, on the cover of Time magazine. His longtime wife and political confidant dies. He gets remarried to this much younger woman who's the hottest fashion model in America. She makes the cover of Life magazine, a woman named Sloane Simpson, you know, probably the only first lady of, I'm sure the only first lady of New York ever made the cover of Life. They're this kind of glamorous political couple. And then he, you know, he has various health problems, but he gets reelected, and then claiming health problems, gets himself appointed ambassador to Mexico and abruptly resigns. And then it starts to come out that he may have had something to do with the murder of this mob witness who was under his care and protection at the time, back in 1941. And he gets dragged before the Kefauver Committee, which was really putting on the first ever televised corruption hearings in history. And this just fascinated the American public. In New York, they were actually showing it in movie theaters, making out that it was a public benefit. You know, this is really showing TV's power for the first time. You know, newspapers were running ads saying, ladies, we know the corruption hearings are fascinating, but you've got to get down here and shop for Easter. You know, this was how big it was. And he does terribly in front of that. So he goes back down to Mexico, and he's, you know, he's resigned as ambassador, but he stays there for years, out of fear that he'll be indicted. And, the real O'Dwyer had a much younger brother named Paul O'Dwyer, who was a terrific political gadfly around New York for years. He ran for everything. He was into every cause. He was a real fighting liberal. He ran guns to the IRA. He ran guns to the Haganah in Israel's independence. He was a great advocate for the waves of Puerto Ricans who were coming, the first kind of big waves of immigration to New York at this point. A great advocate for civil rights, really fought to desegregate a lot of the city. Got himself elected to various posts, usually lost, but had a great big shock of white hair. He's around forever, lived into his 90s, and was a real political icon around New York, and he was the much younger brother. So in the book, I have Charlie O'Kane, the William O'Dwyer figure, in Mexico, where he stayed and for a long time, and with his second wife, who was very unhappy, and she actually takes up bullfighting, which is, again, a real story. And Tom O'Kane has come down to try to clear his brother's name, to try to find out what really happened and how he can set things right. And that's you know, kind of where the story takes off from.
If you just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Kevin Baker about his new novel, The Big Crowd.
And as you say, he's a real crusader. I mean, this is really a story of a kind of morality play in some ways, or these characters. I mean, he himself wants his brother to be clean. I mean, doesn't even imagine that his brother might not be totally clean. And his brother himself is also a very nuanced character. I mean, he's not just a glad-handing politician. I mean, yes, he's incredibly ambitious, but he has a certain degree of insight and complexity as well. Tell us a little bit more about Charlie O'Kane.
Yeah, very much so. The book is meant to explore, and I hope does explore, a lot of, you know, what it takes to get and hold power. And when does, you know, what sacrifices do you make that are worthwhile? You know, what do you do in terms of compromises that are worth it because you've improved a lot of all kinds of people? And which ones do you just kind of slip into utter corruption? And I think this is the sort of conundrum politicians, at least politicians who care at all, deal with all the time. And I think a lot of people don't realize how slippery the slope is and how blurred the distinction is between compromise and corruption. It's a very hard thing to deal with, and it very much entails working in the real world. And that's sort of the difference between the brothers, too, at least to start with, that Charlie is somebody who's really had to go, you know, he's older, he knows the city, he's been there for a long time, and, you know, he's having to make deals and try to advance himself in various ways, all the while doing considerable good. And his brother is very much more idealistic. He's just off the boat from Ireland, and he's incredibly idealistic about America, and he wants to just kind of go forward and you know, launch into these good causes. But of course, that's not always terribly effectual. So, you know, that constant compromise between doing the right thing and between being able to do anything is what I hope I have going on in the book here.
And I'd like to get back to one of those good causes, the whole mob scene on the front, the longshoreman front in Red Hook. But before we do that, I want to say also that Tommy is not pure as a driven snow either. He's made his own moral compromises. Why did you want to insert, you know, his own failings, his own moral failings in the book? And they're not political failings in this case.
Right. They're personal failings. And I must state here, too, that these are actually really fictionalized. This refers to, you know, an affair he has that did not, in fact, take place, as far as we know, and I mean, but I wanted to get in kind of the another one of the things people face in public life, you know, deciding between what you owe the people you love and are close to and what you owe the public, and also in terms of private and public corruption. You know, you hear silly things all the time, like if such and such would lie to his wife, then he'd lie to the public. Well, it's rarely that simple. You know, these are very complicated relationships, and somebody who might be a very good person in private life might be a terrible or corrupt politician and leader. Somebody who might be, at the same point, great men are rarely good men. You know, somebody who is a terrific leader might have all kinds of moral failings at home, but then is he not worthwhile as a leader? So does that kind of mix between public and private morality. And I think, again, you know, it's not simple. It's, you know, to a certain degree, once you start to do things in any realm of your life that are corrupt and underhanded and secretive, possibly you start to do them in other realms of life. But it's not, the two are not easily set apart from each other.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen that just recently, you know, in the New York election that just took place. I mean, Eliot Spitzer, who I think was a very talented and courageous reforming politician who was brought down by his sexual peccadilloes, and I think probably really suffered from that in the election.
Very much so. I think that's a very good example. I mean, with Spitzer, it gets a little more complicated because he was somebody who had actually, in his position, had actually prosecuted people for what was actually the crime he had committed in going to prostitutes. But yeah, but essentially it's something that people think of really as a private crime, if they think of it as a crime at all. And, you know, should that keep him from public service? On the other hand, there are limits to what you can do. I mean, I was really struck by how much younger people were not much worried about all of the nonsense with Anthony Weiner and sexting, because, you know, for them, apparently it seems like this seems like something you do after a drunken fraternity party at college. You know, for people of a certain age like me, this seems like jumping out from behind a tree and opening an overcoat, you know, a raincoat.
Exactly.
It's kind of shocking. But I think it does, I think there is a space too, though, where, you know, leadership is this very complicated thing, and I think there are limits to how much you can reveal of yourself privately, and to how much you can reveal of your private self and still be an effectual leader. You know, you still, to a certain degree, need to present at least a front that inspires people. And I think Weiner, you know, went speeding through that barrier and crashed. You know, Spitzer, it was a more careful case, but it was a closer case, maybe. But I think, to a certain degree, once your entire sex life is out there, it can be pretty difficult to lead.
not to speak of the images. Yes, but the reverse might also be true, because I think in your book, Kevin Baker, in your latest and wonderful novel, The Big Crowd, one of the lead characters, Charlie O'Kane, also gets corrupted by his image to some degree. He can't, you know, he gets to the point where he doesn't integrate his his private morality, or he tries to sheet. I don't know what I'm trying to say. I'm going to let you say it, actually.
Well, yeah, there is a sense of him being very sorry for himself and thinking of himself in this heroic way and not willing to deal with certain things. And that was sort of the case with the real William O'Dwyer, too. He gave these very self-pitying interview for the journalists who came down to Mexico, and I've relied upon a lot of them to get, to build the character. But there's also a sense of, like, both with the real O'Dwyer and with O'Kane in this, I hope, you get a real sense of, at times, he's almost a cinematic creation. You know, he was very much a product of Tammany Hall, the big Democratic old-school political organization, which was very much on the ropes in the 1930s because the good government types had finally come up with somebody in the person of Fiorello LaGuardia, yeah, who was not only for good government, but who was ethnic, who was on the side of the people, who was very liberal and progressive. So Tammany was sort of in trouble with that. And you almost get the feeling when you look at O'Dwyer's career that he's sort of the cinematic creation or the sort of simulacrum of the reformer, you know, that Tammany is putting forward as its good face. You know, I don't think any of this was done intentionally in or some conspiratorial way, but it was, he's almost this image, this the movie version of the crusading DA. And whether or not there was anything behind that, or whether, you know, what was behind that was compromised too much or not, well, that's what you have to read the book for. But that's what the mystery is.
And the big crowd does refer to this kind of intersection of politicians. You got Tammany Hall, the mob, you know, not just Murder, Inc., but the mob as a whole in New York City, and businessmen, commerce, this tripartite ruling class, basically, in New York. You have a marvelously painted scene at a dinner in 1940,
yeah,
the night of the racket for Joe Ryan, with the mobsters clumsy with their forks, and mixing in with the high and mighty. Was it really like this?
Oh, yeah, very much so. That's based very closely on reality, and these were amazing scenes. And then later on, I have to a beefsteak, which were also these almost frighteningly primal get-togethers where a lot of these kind of high mucky-mucks in New York, these, you know, of course, all white men at the time, would get together and they'd put on big aprons over their suits and they'd devour beefsteaks only with their hands. Buttered beefsteaks served on these big platters, and then would come out with that and bread and, you know, and some beer, and they just, like, you know, wipe their hands on their smocks and just, eat away with their hands. This is the thing. The term big crowd was one that was used to describe the people around the president of Mexico at the time, President Alemán, I think that's how it's pronounced, but who was, O'Dwyer actually became an associate with, too, when he went down there. But in this case, I've kind of transferred it to the New York of the time. And this is the interesting thing. You know, you had all these guys, these high mucky mucks. You know, you had all this kind of power elite of people like Robert Moses, who actually gained a great deal of his power under William O'Dwyer, was granted all these extraordinary powers. People like him, people like Cardinal Spellman, the big Cold War cardinal who was wielding all sorts of power. From St. Patrick's, Subway Sam Rostoff, this big developer who probably had a union leader killed, Generoso Pope, this kind of neo-fascist newspaper publisher and contractor who, again, had a leading leftist killed. And the guy who really fascinated me, William McCormick, who, you know, real name, real story, another guy came up from nothing, was a teamster on the docks, son of a famine Irish couple who had come over in the 1840s, worked his way up, and very quietly, very behind the scenes, had controlling interests in all these activities around the docks, owned a dredging company and an oil company and a trucking company and owned docks, and was also the man who controlled the International Longshoremen's Association through this sort of puppet president for life, King Joe Ryan, who the racket is for. And that's where the term comes from, by the way. Rackets were originally these parties that Tammany ward healers would give for themselves and literally make a racket. You know? And you were kind of required to buy tickets to it, at least, and or show up if you were a mobster in the area who wanted to go on doing business, if you ran various establishments and wanted to go on doing business. So that's, you know, that's where the term the rackets comes from. But, you know, these men were kind of all working together, and they all thought of themselves, they all thought it perfectly fitting that they should run the city, that they were the most capable, talented people out there, that they knew how to wield power, and they generally told themselves that they were working in the best interests of people. And this was something, you know, they did have an enormous amount of power, especially Moses, especially McCormick, who really just ran, you know, he ran the biggest, far and away, the biggest harbor in America. You know, where he could shut it down, he could open it up. But what they didn't get was that this was a different age now, that after the New Deal and after LaGuardia and with the GI Bill and what everybody had been through in World War II, this was now an America of what was then called the common man. This is an America of everyone now. And people no longer needed to depend on these sorts of bosses, whether they were mob bosses or political bosses or new bosses like Moses. They could make their own way in life more than ever before. And this was going to lead to, and the refusal of the big crowd, of these powerful men, to acknowledge that, and their refusal to acknowledge their rampant self-interest in what they were doing, really would cause huge problems for New York. And this more than, you know, you have various explanations given for the kind of meltdown of New York in the 60s and 70s, and it was never a total meltdown, but for the bad times, and things are, you know, well, they were, you know, too liberal with welfare money, well, they did this or that, whatever. A lot of it was decisions these guys made in their self-interest, such as Robert Moses driving the Cross Bronx Expressway through middle-class neighborhoods across the Bronx. It was William McCormick kind of letting the port fall to pieces because he didn't want to give up any power, and letting it physically, the docks physically fall apart, which meant that the shipping industry left New York Harbor. You know, these sorts of decisions really had very deleterious effects on New York. And it really was a thing that you just couldn't, you know, the country could not be run by, you know, and the city could not be run by some small group of well-connected people, you know. And of course, excuse me, you mentioned the mob, of course, to enforce a lot of this power, they'd had to rely on all sorts of nefarious individuals, such as the mob. You know, William McCormick, who controlled all these docks, he was a very pious Catholic, a daily communicant, and he liked to talk about subsidiarity, a part of Catholic theology that Paul Ryan actually brought up during the campaign last year. It was very much entails like working with, you know, without any official government structure, just working face to face with your men as fellow Catholics. But you know, that was sort of a smokescreen. In reality, what he was doing was having some of the worst killers in mob history, people like Albert Anastasia, who Abe Relis was supposed to testify against, you know, go and brutalize these men on the docks and, you know, steal every last penny they could from these already pretty poor workers, and if they objected, beat them up or kill them. And they thought, you know, McCormick thought he could just kind of go on running things forever, running this empire in this way. And it was a different world after the war. And neither he nor the rest of the big crowd really wanted to acknowledge that.
Kevin Baker talking about his latest novel, The Big Crowd. It's based on the true story of one of New York City's most famous Tammany Hall mayors, Bill O'Dwyer, and a still unsolved mob-related murder that happened under his watch. We'll talk more with Baker after the break. Stay tuned.
All the sisters of mercy, they are not departed or gone. They were waiting for me when I thought that I just can't go on. And they brought me their comfort, and later they brought me this song.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with novelist Kevin Baker about his new book, The Big Crowd. It's the first of a new trilogy about New York taking place in the post-war years. Before the break, Baker was talking about Big Bill McCormick's reign of terror over the longshoremen of the New York City docks. It was most famously portrayed in the great movie with Marlon Brando, On the Waterfront. Let's pick up the thread there.
Of course, I'd seen On the Waterfront many years ago, but this really gave a context to it. And you mentioned Pete Panto before. This was a figure I knew nothing about. Tell us about him. And he was, of course, one of the victims.
Yeah, Pete Panto is, you know, I first learned about him through Nathan Ward's wonderful book, Dark Harbor. But he was a dissident longshoreman. And again, like somebody out of a movie, although very sincere, very young guy, you know, was not going to go along with business as usual on the docks, and led this sort of dissident movement within the union, within the International Longshoremen's Association, and got a lot of followers. And very quickly, the people who were running the union for King Joe Ryan and for William McCormick, you know, came down on him and tried to, you know, first they tried to bribe him, and he refused that, and then they were looking to kill him, and, you know, they weren't able to, they just missed doing that a couple times. But he had a lot of protection from these men. And he was really, you know, he was, Panto was also like a character from the movies. He'd go into these old union halls that literally had not been used for decades because the union was just controlled. And he would make these, and go into the churches along the waterfront, make these fiery speeches and get these union men, you know, roused and, you know, shouting to the rafters. And but so then they arrange a meeting with him that is supposed to be this meeting to really address the grievances. And he gets an assurance from somebody, it seems, that it's okay to go to this meeting. And that's the interesting thing. Nobody knows who this was, if there was someone. But it almost certainly had to be someone who gave him an assurance it was okay to go to this meeting. We don't know who. And he goes to the meeting, and he is never seen again. He goes out of his boarding house. He didn't even own a phone. This guy was like a labor saint, you know. He tells his fiance if he's not back by morning to call the police, but he goes out and gets in this car in Brooklyn, and about 18 months later, I think they find his body in a, you know, what remains of his body in a mob dumping place in a chicken farm over in New Jersey. And, you know, his whole disappearance just really incensed the people on his side in the union, you know, and they were for months afterwards. You'd see this graffiti written around in these various walls, and even pamphlets saying "Dove Panto," you know, by these Italian longshoremen in Brooklyn, saying, you know, where is Panto? And this was sort of ignored by the rest of New York, and that's the interesting thing too. The docks were so cut off; they were like another world, which both Bud Schulberg in writing On the Waterfront and Arthur Miller in A View from the Bridge were stunned to discover how, not, you know, for Miller, not far at all, just a few blocks from where he was living in Brooklyn Heights, was this whole other world that was extremely brutal and violent and poor and served a vital function in the country and in New York, and most New Yorkers barely paid attention to it. You know, and suddenly these mysterious words start appearing, you know, Dove Panto. But, you know, then the war started, so they kind of went back to ignoring that. But, you know, this was going to come out sooner or later. Interesting, too, you mentioned On the Waterfront, which was Schulberg's script. And, you know, at the very end of it, they have a thing where they say, you know, who's Marlon Brando's character is in front of the committee, and he says, you know, and they ask him, like, who's behind all this on the waterfront? And somebody says, it's Mr. Big. And you cut to the back of somebody's head in a chair, and he's got a butler. He's obviously very wealthy. He tells the butler to turn off the TV. That's supposed to be Mr. Big. You never see his face. And I thought this was just a Hollywood trope. You know, we don't want to blame the unions or the workers too much, so there's Mr. Big. But no, it really was. It really was this guy, William McCormick, who was kind of running things. And, you know, and that power was not going to last. But a lot of, you know, good people, a lot of good men were sacrificed to their attempts to hang on to power.
And, you know, New York certainly is still a city in which there are big interests that control things. I mean, we've got this New York City has this billionaire mayor who is now going to be succeeded by, well, is he going to be the second Fiorello LaGuardia? I don't know. Well, we don't know yet if he will be actually elected, but it looks like a pretty sure bet at this point. Could you talk about the relevance, you know, the resonance of this wonderful novel, The Big Crowd, taking place in the 1950s and 40s to today?
Yeah, it's really interesting how much it is, I think. And I think there, you know, it's very interesting seeing this race and seeing all of that. And we talked before about, you know, private lives and public lives. I mean, you know, de Blasio is sort of an interesting example of kind of the opposite we were talking about, of like how, you know, you have to have a certain amount of something inspiring in your private life. You know, not that many years ago, de Blasio's private life, being married to an African-American woman who was in the past said she was a lesbian, and having mixed-race kids, would have been considered quite shocking and automatically disqualified him for citywide office, you know, wrongly, horribly, but would have. And now it's, in fact, one of his greatest appeals, which is, you know, I think a terrific thing and shows how much the city and the country have changed. You know, and in any case, we're going to get a mayor from Brooklyn, which will be fun, I think. But I think a lot, you know, it's interesting seeing Joe Lahota's campaign, too, which is very much based, it's so far at least, on bringing back all the worries about, you know, it's kind of the city of fear. You know, look out, if you elect this guy, you're going to get crime in the streets and, you know, all sorts of horrible things again, and it'll be terrible. And I don't think that has that much appeal because, you know, I don't think people worry that much about crime in a city where they can't live. You know, I think the biggest fear now with New Yorkers is they're not going to be able to afford to stay in the city, even if they make a very good income. It's just so wealthy and so crowded. You know, and this is really, you know, how it differs from things in the past. I mean, it's interesting with somebody like Mayor Bloomberg, who is, you know, it's it's almost bizarre. You know, he's like, well, we'll elect the richest man in town to be mayor. And but he's, you know, he's a different sort of creature than the old big crowd, in the sense that he is somebody who was so independently wealthy that he's not even a part of any of these sort of organizations, or, you know, doesn't really have to compromise much at all. And he brings in various advisors of his own. He's not beholden to people. So that's sort of a different thing. But it's, again, I think people have wearied about, you know, and in many ways has probably run the city fairly well. I mean, his government seems honest. It seems to be full of bright people. They've done some good things for the city. But, again, I think it leads to the question of who is the city, who is this bright, shiny new city for? You know, exactly. Is it for us, or is it for, you know, the elite
developers
who can afford to live here? You know, it's the land of the $25 hamburger, you know?
Exactly.
I mean, you know, it becomes the big question. How are we going to, you know, stay here? And that's, you know, as I was interviewing the mayor the other day for something, and he was saying, like, our problems are problems of success. And I think he's right in many ways, but I think that's also, you know, problematic for a lot of people. You know, it's yes, it is nice that the city is so attractive to so many billionaires from around the world. On the other hand, are we going to have a situation, you know, like in London now, they have this thing where even some of the best neighborhoods in the city are basically deserted most of the time, because they're so owned by these foreign billionaires who show up for like 2 weeks a year to maintain some kind of residency, you know, nobody else is there, you know. And it's sort of vaguely starting to happen here. Like, you have, like, the Plaza, I guess, is now mostly condominiums, and it's apparently mostly vacant most nights. You know,
right.
It's a historic building in the center of the city, you know, and it's just, so it's sort of like, well, is this just going to be another preserve for the rich, or is it going to be New York? And I think that's what's really driving a lot of things now.
Yeah, and it also goes right along with it, the greatest inequality. I mean, it's here is really Wall Street, and it is interesting. I mean, Wall Street didn't have the kind of power, I guess, back in, I mean, am I right that the business interests, there was the mob and there were the business interests that were very much working hand in hand in the time of the big crowd of your novel, but not Wall Street playing the kind of role that it does now. Am I right about that? Or
no, I think you were right. I mean, obviously it was powerful, and obviously there were powerful people there, but it was a little bit in the doghouse still from the Depression. You know, these people were, you know, unlike today, when they seem to be simply outraged anyone would object to them wrecking the world financial system as they did 5 years ago. At the time, they were a little bit in disgrace, and they sort of knew it. So they kept a lower profile, and they were reined in by a lot of New Deal regulations that were a very good idea and should have stayed in place. So they had maybe less power than they did any other time in the city's history. And again, big money had a lot of power, but you know, they were sort of more restrained. The transition that was going on, and it's kind of fascinating, was between the mob and the politicians. And traditionally, politicians in New York had controlled the mob. They controlled the gangsters. They were very useful for certain things, like they could get them to throw ballot boxes in the river if you had to, and go and beat up people at the voting places. You know, horrible stuff, but the politicians were still in charge. That's why things like the Sullivan Law came in after Big Tim Sullivan, leading Tammany politician. And he put it in place so that, you know, it forbid you to carry concealed guns. So if a gangster got out of hand, he'd have his cops arrest him, and they would plant a gun on him, and off the guy would go to prison for a year. It told you who was in charge. What changed all that was one of the most ill-conceived social experiments in our history, which is to say Prohibition. And this gave the mob so much money almost overnight that for the first time they were kind of able to reverse the equation, and they had more power than the politicians. Now, mob power is almost always exaggerated in the history of American life. There's always this popular thing that they control everything and they shot President Kennedy, did this, you know, a lot of it's nonsense. But at this point in history, right after, you know, LaGuardia is able to at least fight the mob to kind of a standstill, and he, you know, literally exiles a number of mobsters like Oney Madden from the city. But when he's gone, and it's kind of this wide-open city again, you have the mob come back, and they have more money than they've ever had, and now they're controlling the politicians. And so, for instance, like once O'Dwyer resigns in 1950, the special election that's called is, you know, between Vincent Impalateri, who's the acting mayor, and Ferdinand Pecora. Is described as, you know, the Genovese money versus Gambino money or something like that, between these two mob families. There's all this mob money sloshing around, there's all this influence. It's very pernicious. It's very pernicious effects on the city. Now, that will, their power quickly starts to fade again as people start to come down on them and rein them in. You know, it's sort of the thing that New York is always part, you know, kind of these contending forces that generally, sooner or later, exert a sort of restraint on people, you know. I mean, at the time, for instance, right after the post-war era, you had people who actually made things and ran companies that made things, having power, as well as people who, you know, pushed paper on Wall Street. So you had that kind of restraint even within, you know, big power capitalism. It's very interesting. One of the things I got into about Cardinal Spellman, who was running what became known as the powerhouse. He was the cardinal of New York. The rectory outside of behind St. Patrick's Cathedral, where he lived and worked, was known as the powerhouse because he had so much power. And one of the ways he got it was, you know, almost overnight, with World War II, this became the richest archdiocese in the world, and it included a lot of these Catholic businessmen who, for the first time, had considerable wealth. And Spellman very cleverly got them to contribute large amounts of money to the church by giving them kind of these papal knighthoods. So here were these, you know, these guys who come up often as poor Catholic boys, Irish and Italian ethnic guys, and they were knights, you know. They you know, forked over all this money and made these deals. You know, it's Joe Kennedy, he got Joe Kennedy to cut this deal, giving up the buildings across Madison Avenue from the back of St. Patrick's in exchange for being able to buy the Chicago Mart, which became a huge rock of the Kennedy fortune for years. You know, there was this sort of interaction there that was, you know, that included these sort of emerging classes of people. That was, you know, in some ways a good thing. Other ways it became a little corrupted too. But it's fascinating, all the kind of, you know, the ebb and flow of power and money in this city.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Kevin Baker, I'd like to, in the few minutes we have left, I'd like to ask you something about the writing of the book, because you tell this story, The Big Crowd, mostly through dialogue, and I think you really do it brilliantly. How did you get the language of the time so right?
Oh, thanks. I mean, I relied on a lot of, you know, more than I have in the past, a lot of kind of the popular, you know, magazine and newspaper writing of the time, which there's some great interviews by, I think it's Philip Hamburger, I have it in the back of the book there, but who went down and interviewed O'Dwyer in Mexico, and other interviews on him and Collier's and life. It was a great era for magazine writing, and there was some terrific stuff to draw upon there. I wanted to keep a certain tone in it that matched the period, both in terms of literature and in the story, which is what I always try to do in these historical novels. So I was reading a lot of Raymond Chandler throughout this, you know, and trying to really kind of get into those rhythms, those amazing descriptions he has, trying to channel some of those for what is, after all, this to a certain extent, this noir story here. You know, I hope I did it.
Well, it is just a terrific book, and this has been a fascinating interview. Kevin Baker, thank you so much for talking with us here about your latest novel, The Big Crowd, and I really look forward to the sequels in this series.
Great. There are going to be a couple other fascinating things in New York at the time. One, the basketball scandals, and other, the quiz show scandals, and sort of the aftermath of those, and they were also part of this whole City of Gold era, where, you know, corruption just was constantly seeping up around the corners.
Kevin Baker. His new novel is The Big Crowd. Read an excerpt at writersvoice.net. This is Halloween week. A good time for a ghost story. A real one. This clip comes from my 2012 interview with Steve Volk about his journalistic investigation into paranormal phenomena. When he was a kid, his family had encounters of a decidedly spooky kind with a ghost that was haunting their house.
It's a fairly outlandish story. I mean, I was around 5 or 6 years old when it all happened, so I have fragmentary memories of it all. But there was a really loud booming sound, thudding sound, that would happen in the middle of the night. My sisters down the hall thought it was coming from up in the walls of their room. And then my brother and I on the other side of the house, we didn't share an adjoining wall, thought it was coming from the roof over our heads. And it would seem to at times, you know, move around to us. And my parents downstairs, it was so loud that my parents downstairs were also woken up by it. And the thing is, you know, they looked for prosaic explanations. I think one of the problems I have with kind of the state of modern skepticism is they think that people hear a weird sound and they go, oh, ghost. And look, in my ghost hunting, you know, sort of travels that I did from the book, I mean, I did find some people who did react that way. And I was very quickly able to debunk sort of what it was that they were reporting. But lots and lots of people spend many, many weeks and months, if not longer, looking for more mundane explanations. And my family fell into that category. My parents, you know, thought about things like water hammers. And, you know, and then it quickly becomes apparent that that sort of typical plumbing problem wasn't going to be the explanation, because the noise went on far longer than any kind of water hammer would. I mean, it would go on for minutes, tens of minutes. It would happen way high up in the walls. The pipes on the second floor only went up part of the way into the wall. There was just no way, you know, that these things were the explanation. They tried to recreate the noise. They wondered if somehow one of us was doing something. They would bang on our headboards in various rooms and see if somehow, you know, we were creating the noise. They would open and close closet doors, you know what I mean? Like, really roughly, trying to figure out, well, if I just keep opening and closing, does that sound like, you know, they couldn't find anything that accounted for it. And so they got tired, ultimately, of being woken up out of bed by this. And they were troubled because my sisters were reporting more dramatic things than that banging kind of noise. My sisters were saying that blankets were being pulled from their beds in the middle of the night. My sisters were saying that, you know, an old woman walked through the room, that the bed frame would shake in the middle of the night, like somebody was grabbing both, you know, the posts of the bed and twisting it left and right, you know, as violently as they could. So I think that my parents were simultaneously, you know, dismissive of that sort of story because they weren't encountering that directly and they didn't want to believe it was true, but I do think it also affected them. And so ultimately, when they couldn't come up for an explanation, even for the noise itself, my dad went and talked to the family priest. And the family priest came over and he blessed the house. And when he did, I'll never forget this, he turned to my dad as he left and said, you know, so this wasn't like a full-blown exorcism, don't get confused, you know. This is me talking, not the priest. This was the way Catholics do when they move into a house. The priest will come over and bless it. So he agreed to come over and do a blessing ceremony. In fact, it was his idea when my dad told him what was happening. So he comes over and he blesses the house, and on his way out the door, he says to my dad, hey, you know, so long, Jerry, I'm sure everything will be fine. But the fact is, that night, the noise actually went on longer and louder than ever. And for the first time ever, it really assumed a precise location. Instead of coming from this amorphous sort of position somewhere up in the house, it hit at the top of the stairs, and then it came down one step at a time. Like a child throwing a tantrum is how my dad describes it. And when it hit the bottom, that was it, and we never heard it again.
Wow, that's such an amazing story. You must have been terrified.
I have some vague memories of that last night when it was going on in a really sort of fierce way. What's been even more moving to me since then, though, is hearing my family talk about it, in particular my parents. I mean, I conducted a real sort of formal interview of them at one point, and they were still freaked out by that event. My mom's color changed, you know what I mean? Like, they were sort of white-faced, they held hands across the table. They were still very bothered by it.
Yeah, so, I mean, I can imagine that, and actually, I don't think I've ever seen a ghost, but I've seen something that I could not understand. And I'm saying this, I know, at the risk of people thinking me a wacko. I did have an experience once when I was renting a room in a house that I was living in. I hadn't gone into the room much before I rented it. I had just moved into the house. I brought in the prospective roommate. I opened up the closet to show her what it was. And we both saw the most bizarre thing I think I've ever seen in my life, which is something that had red eyes and just blackness around it.
Wow.
And we closed the door, looked at each other, acknowledged that we had seen something that we couldn't understand, and then went on as if nothing had happened.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to process this, so I just haven't. I don't. I know it happened. I had independent confirmation with the person who was there with me. We acknowledged it and went on. You, how about yourself? Now that you've done all this research and all this writing in the book Fringeology, how do you now process or think about what happened to you as a child?
That's a great question. And I think, by the way, what you describe is very common. You know, people just sort of go on. It wasn't as if my family obsessed over that ghost after it stopped. We would bring it up from time to time. When the movie Poltergeist came out, you know, it sort of became almost a Christmas movie for us. Whereas most families saw it as a horror story, we saw it as like, you know, hey, great, you know, somebody's really, you know, done this right. And so, I mean, there were some changes there, you know, but for the most part, we just sort of went on about our lives. And the intriguing thing for me with this book was to wonder where it would leave me at the end, because certainly I've written enough stories over the years that I know that stories that aren't even that personal sometimes change me. And so I did wonder, how am I going to come out of this? And I have to tell you, I look at the family ghost now as an incredible lesson in humility, because I do not know what the ultimate explanation of those events were. I do know that, you know, it wasn't just superstition and creaking floorboards, right? And then beyond that, it's just this great mystery. And I use the word great advisedly, because I think we're far better off if we acknowledge mysteries in this world than if we simply wave our hand at them and deem them entirely insignificant or claim we have an explanation for them when the real fact is we don't.
Steve Volk talking about his book Fringeology in 2012. Go to writersvoice.net to hear the entire interview. Finally, here's a review of John Bradshaw's wonderful book about the new science of cats. It's a must for all cat lovers. I got a cat last year from my local shelter. Ruby is a sweet kitty, but for a long time, she was a bit of a puzzle. She's clearly attached to me because she stays close, but she's no lap cat, and for a long time, she didn't even like to be petted. That changed after a few months and lots of treats. But it wasn't until I read Cat Sense by John Bradshaw that I understood why Ruby was initially so reluctant. It seems there's a brief window for socializing kittens to humans, such that they'll seek and stay on laps, after which time it's much more difficult. And Ruby had been brought in from the wild with her mother and sibling after that window had closed. This is just one of the many fascinating insights into cat behavior Bradshaw gives in Cat Sense. Subtitled How the New Feline Science Can Make You a Better Friend to Your Pet, the book explores the evolution, genetics, and behavior of cats and shows how the species has adapted to the human environment without losing much of its wild nature. But that adaptation is less complete than dogs, because dogs are pack animals that cooperate, while cats are largely solitary. Also, dogs have been bred into work animals highly dependent on signals from people to do their work. Cats are hunters, something done alone and in competition with other cats. Bradshaw says many cats living in multi-cat households are barely tolerating their feline housemates. Despite their reputation for aloofness, cats are as capable of great affection for humans as dogs, and they can be trained. They've been domesticated for a long time, probably since the invention of agriculture some 10,000 years ago, when grain stores attracted both rats and their feline predators. And Bradshaw surmises it was the Egyptians' worship of cats which most likely led to their actual domestication as pets. But cats' needs and motivations are still very much tied to the wild parts of their nature. For instance, even older cats need to play at hunting to keep from getting bored. Toys are perfect substitutes for the real thing, but the most satisfying ones are capable of being torn apart by kitty. And our lack of understanding of cats may bode ill for their future as pets. Bradshaw warns we may be breeding domesticity out of our cats by neutering so many before they have a chance to reproduce. When only feral cats are having kittens, the evolutionary pressure to be comfortable around humans disappears. Cat Sense goes a long way toward educating humans about their feline companions so that we can continue to enjoy them and make them happier to be around us. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.